Welcome to Season 4 of Lightwork Presents Everything is Connected, where we share the interesting and inspiring stories of artists, critical thinkers, thought leaders, and art professionals on a wide range of topics about life, work, and our world. We share ideas on our inspirations and the influences that affect our lives. I'm your host, Fola Shadi Olugundudu, and I look forward to sharing the conversations I have with artists and creative professionals across the art industry and beyond. As I travel to art fairs, gallery openings, and events within the creative industries both in the U.S. and abroad, join me in discovering and learning about some of today's most interesting and dynamic artists and creative professionals. If you're new to the show, I'm happy to have you here. If you've been on this journey with me, welcome back. Let's get it. On this episode, I'm joined by Adrian Elise Tarver. Adrian Elise Tarver is an interdisciplinary artist based in Brooklyn, New York. Her practice spans painting, sculpture, installation, photography, textiles, and video. Her work addresses the complexity and invisibility of the Black female identity, including the history within domestic spaces, the fantasy of the tropical seductress, and the archetype of the all-knowing spiritual matriarch. Adrian is just 1 week away from opening her latest solo show, and her fourth with Dinner Gallery, when we sit down to talk about her work and practice. Let's dive into my next episode with Adrian Elise Tarver. Adrian Elise Tarver, I'm so happy to have you join me on an episode of Everything is Connected. Really looking forward to chatting with you today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and chatting with you today.
Wonderful. Let's jump right in. So I know you have a show opening at Dinner Gallery next week, Thursday, and it'll be your fourth solo with the gallery. Can you talk to me a little bit about the show, Where the Waters Go?
It's definitely a continuation of previous themes and ideas in my work. And specifically, there's this character that I've developed in my work, a fictional character that started from finding an old photograph in a thrift store in Chicago when I was in grad school. And I've really built this story around her in order to use her as a surrogate to talk about larger issues and concerns, hopes, fears, things I think about, but particularly things that revolve around and relate to the Black woman and our identity and visibility within most of the spaces we move through. And then this show in particular kind of connects her to some of my own personal histories. Over the last few years, I've been doing some research on my family history in different locations. And so there's a plantation called Tarver Plantation that comes into play in this exhibition. It kind of is a merging of the Vera Otis story, who's the fictional character, and my personal history.
Yes. And in thinking about Vera Otis and this fictional character that you've created and this image that you found in a thrift store, can you dig a little bit in more into what are some of the things that were leading you in this direction? Because I would imagine that it's a constellation of ideas and thoughts that have come over time, ways of thinking, ways of being. But why this fictional character, and why using something that doesn't exist to tell a story of a life that might have existed, or a person that might have existed?
It's a great question, and I started thinking about this route in grad school, even though I didn't really start the character Vera Otis until after grad school, and it came about because I was using old family photographs. I was really interested in my family and family history, and I found it a little bit confining to stick to people that I know and the histories that I know and the photographs that I know. And it was too close to home in a way that didn't really let me expand on all of these other things I was thinking about and all of these things that like relate to myself, my family, people that I know. So the fictional character just allowed me more breathing room, I think, and more creative license to integrate multiple stories into one person. So there can be many things happening in her life and story that integrate things that might be from my mom telling me stories, or my grandmother, or my aunts, or things that happened to me, or famous characters, famous people. I've been looking a lot at Black entertainers and actresses, particularly women, from the first half of the 20th century, maybe from maybe 1920 to actually maybe a little bit later, 1960, 1970. And some of those stories I can fold in without it being about them and not about being about my family.
Yeah, I love that you've expanded on that and shared a bit more about that. Can you talk about the fact that this is your fourth solo exhibition with Dinner Gallery and just what the building of that relationship has been like over time and how you've grown, not only as an artist, but with the gallery as well and with the work that you're creating?
Yeah, it's one of the really nice things about having a longer relationship with a gallery or dealer or anybody who's been in your studio over years is there's a shortcut. There's this shorthand of I didn't have to explain the Vera Otis character when I was like, okay, I'm coming back to Vera. And Celine, who runs the gallery, knows who Vera Otis is. And she was there the first iteration of the Vera project. And the first show I had with Dinner Gallery before, they were called Victory and Mo. And we showed video project and had some photos and very much about her domestic space. And I've fully drawn upon all of that work that I did years ago. That was like 2016, 2017, when I was like really constructing, what does her home look like? What are the things that she owns? What is her life? And now it's just like information that exists for me. It's she's becoming more real. And so now as I'm making new work, new paintings, new images, I'm just pulling on the things I've actually already created years ago and like working it in with new research and new thoughts and new information.
Yes. A few questions that are like more deeply connected to your practice overall. You're an interdisciplinary artist and your work spans painting, sculpture, installation, photography, textiles, and video. What do you find appealing about these different mediums?
All of them provide a different way of translating information, communicating something. My first love is painting. I always will love painting. It's how what I went to school for, what I have my degrees in, and I still love being in the studio painting. But I started to explore other mediums because there were moments in which I just felt like a painting wasn't going to satisfy the idea. Like the ideas, the concepts are happening at the same time as I'm thinking about some maybe formal issues with the painting. But there's times where I'm recognizing they're just not going to coalesce the way I want them to. And so that's started different trains of thought of, like, oh, maybe this is a photograph or maybe this is a video. And just really teaching myself different mediums along the way as I'm realizing I want to serve the concept at its best and it needs maybe something other than painting.
Do you have a particular preference for any of them? And if so, would you say why you're drawn to it particularly outside of painting?
Yeah, I was going to say painting, it's the first love. But outside of that, I've been very into video. In this upcoming show, it's mostly paintings, but I will have a new video piece in it as well. And my last solo show at Oshi in LA last year, I had a video piece in addition to others. The videos have been a consistent thing and have kind of ramped up a little bit recently. They really in this idea of what serves the concept, it really gives a different perspective on the things I'm thinking about. So in the same way the Vera character came from an old photograph that I found, I'm really interested in archives and I'm really interested in images that exist, images that have been out in the world in a different way. And so I'm using a lot of archival footage in the video. There is also some footage that I shot, but I like this looking at video as a collage and allowing the histories of the things I'm finding to inform the things I'm creating and then the creation as a whole as I'm putting it together.
Yes, yes. I love that sort of culmination of different things coming together and then birthing something completely new, right? But being deeply inspired from many different places. Next question. Your work deals with the complexity and invisibility of Black female identity, including the history within domestic spaces, the fantasy of the tropical seductress, and the archetype of the all-knowing spiritual matriarch. Can you expand on why this interests you, and what, if anything, do you seek to discover or share through your work?
Yeah, I think these archetypes that have come to mind as I was conceptualizing various bodies of work, particularly Vera Otis and her story, was really about the images I was seeing of Black women growing up or just around at the salon or whatever it was, like these images that are presented as, whether they're aspirational images or just images of what exists, and they fall into a few categories. There's not a huge expansive range for what Black women have been presented as, and so the history and domestic space, like I can find connections to this archetype also through personal stories of my own family or people that I know. And the same idea of the tropical seductress kind of relates to this idea of the fantasy of going home, and that home being this sort of tropical paradise space, especially for the Black diaspora of America. That's like the idea of outside of the American history of a Black person is like these maybe spaces that you have more agency or have more, yeah, power or control over your being. And then the spiritual matriarch is this reoccurring, I think, of like Miss Cleo, or even like Dionne Warwick was like a spokesperson for the Psychic Friends Network, this idea that like Black women have some deep insight into a spiritual realm, which I think is lovely. It's also interesting. It's this like the people who are most traumatized, the people who have the most sort of harm against them are the ones that people assume have the deepest, like to survive, you must have a connection to this other realm. There's this, it goes to the sort of Afrofuturism like ideas as well, of the only space you can be safe is outside of the worldly realm. And so mm-hmm. that idea is also really interesting to me.
Yeah, I love that. This idea that one can only be safe outside of the world and in this kind of maybe a space that you've carved out for oneself, whether that's in your own mind, a world that you're building for yourself in nature. I guess there are different ways that one could access it, but that concept's very interesting to me. It reminds me a little bit about just touching on certain kinds of Buddhist philosophies where you have like this center within yourself that is like untouchable. And almost like a safe space that you create where you can't be impacted by what happens out there in the world or like what you experience. So I love that. I want to go a little bit back to talking a bit about the Tarver Plantation, which you share a namesake with the name of the plantation. And I'm curious to know how it came on your radar, how you discovered the Tarver Plantation, and also how maybe ideas of more historic imagery and your use of the archive really informs the way that you not only think about the past, but possibly thinking about just the future and what doesn't exist yet, but what could exist.
Yeah, that's a great way to ask the question. And because I think it is about what could exist when I think about the histories of something like the Tarver Plantation. I've been aware for a long time. My last name is Tarver. I've been aware that there's a Tarver, Georgia, and a Tarversville, Georgia. My dad's side of the family was from Georgia, my grandfather. And so it was just, I knew that existed. They didn't, when, like, my great-grandmother, who lived in Georgia until she died at 108, did not live in Tarver, Georgia, but not that far from where Tarver, Georgia is. And so I actually moved back to Atlanta. I took a job there in 2019, and I moved there for a couple years. And while I was there, I had this visceral reaction to, okay, as an adult, and I'd lived there as a kid, we'd moved there from, I was aged like 3 to 10. So I'm familiar with Georgia. My parents moved back after they retired. My dad's there now. So Georgia wasn't like an unknown entity to me. And I had this sort of feeling of like, I feel like this is the moment in which I should look more into that history. And it really wasn't that hard to find the history. It's the location that was formerly named the Tarver Plantation no longer goes by that name. But in the 90s, they had applied for historical registry status, and their application was available online. And so I had this trove of images, detailed accounts of how many enslaved people were on the property, what they grew on the property, the different families that had owned the property. And unfortunately, the property at that time was also people, so it had owned this entire sort of estate. And there were 20 images. And the images were just incredible to me, because while I could drive by the location, it's a private property, so I wouldn't have been able to go into the house or even see the house, because it's way down, a long drive, it's a lot of property. And so it really gave me this insight into this physical space, this house, and it's the grandeur of the Southern plantation. And the remnants of slavery are not just the trauma to people individually, that is a huge part of it, and like the generational trauma, but it's also the loss of property, that like not the lack of property, the lack of wealth, the lack of generational wealth. And so to see this monument to this institution still standing with hundreds of acres, and to know that generational lineage of property goes to the people that were enslavers, and that's where that legacy lies. It was this idea of like the possibility of what could be, like that space. It's most likely built by enslaved people at the hands of, and in the ground that exists, these people that don't actually get any remnants of that legacy. And so I think about that physical, and a lot of this upcoming show is about this idea of these spaces and the sort of aspirations and how that's translated over generations in specifically like the Black community, the Black diaspora in America, and what that looks like.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. I think what was coming up for me is how important it is that history is told through the voices and the experiences of people from all different backgrounds and perspectives, and thinking about how much of the world has been organized from such a particular point of view. And when one has agency to share a story that they know to be true and that they've seen and experienced, there's a different kind of lens through which to understand the world. And I think so many of these things are really obvious for us here as people of color, as Americans, whether we want to acknowledge that publicly or not. But that our history is so fraught, and in general, the way that the modern world works is one in which a dominant narrative has been told by a very small set of people. And there's so many different ways to look at and reflect back on history and what has happened, not only in those kind of very tactile ways of not having land and being dispossessed, but also in these kind of more nuanced stories that can be uncovered through how people negotiate and navigate through difficult times and what stories can be birthed out of that. And so I think just in hearing you talk about it, it reminds me of how important it is to do the work of, whether it's through the creative lens as an artist or otherwise, but do the work of uncovering stories that might not have been told and sharing them with a large audience. Can you talk to me a little bit about your experience teaching, the actual environment of being in a room with young minds and talking about art and talking about creativity from your point of view?
Absolutely. And I think there's this constant question, especially when the world is in turmoil, and that's a constant at different points, different things are in turmoil, that there's this question in the classroom of, like, why are we doing this? Like, what students may be having moments of feeling like they don't understand what the purpose is. Like, they love it, but they don't really know why they're doing it. Does it help anything? And I think ultimately art is an expression of our world at any given time, and it's coming from these different perspectives. And people look back at our art to see what was happening, how were people feeling, what was on people's minds, what was the pulse of that generation. And I think there's so much value in putting your own story, the way that you want to talk about whatever it is that you're interested in into the world. And so I think through encouraging students, it helps encourage myself having these conversations and understanding why I'm making work and why I've made work all these years. And they're just interesting. You get to be in a room with a lot of, like, interesting minds who are figuring things out, and different generations have different priorities that are on their mind. So it's always really interesting to sort of see what's at the forefront for the incoming students.
Yes. I think a lot about just the environment of being a student today, right? And what that can be like for young people, right? And how important it is to be around artists who think about the world from a creative point of view, right? And think about the issues that we all face in the world individually and collectively, but through the lens of being a catalyst for change, and art being a catalyst just to start a conversation. And that conversation can also be a part of how change is sparked. But yeah, just loving your reflections on that. Next question. I wonder if we've already covered this, but what would you say are some of the elements that inform your practice? Like, I guess maybe elements isn't the right word, but I guess what I'm thinking about is, when you sit down to begin a new body of work and you're thinking about a new idea that you want to explore, a lot of it based in research, do you spend a long time thinking about things before you start creating? Do you go into the act of creation first and then double back?
Yeah, it's a little of both. I would say heavily research and its interest. I don't think I have a practice that necessarily, if you just, like, glance, if you, like, walk by a show, that necessarily screams visually that, oh, this is a research-based practice. But so much of the work comes from research, and I do a lot of reading in between. After a show, generally there's a little bit of a studio lull, and I'll do a lot of reading, and that kind of gets me back into it. There's always lots of threads in the studio happening at the same time, and so it's never that with this show coming up, and then I have a public art fund project in the fall, both of those things allow me to round out some ideas, but I still have, like, three other threads that I'm not presenting and I haven't rounded out yet. And going back to the studio this time, I'll definitely be fleshing out some of the things that didn't get to be a part of these upcoming shows. But for the most part, there's a lot of reading and then going down some research rabbit holes, whether it's the Tarver Plantation. I've spoken to my aunts about some other histories that I'm really interested in, about different accomplishments of family members way down the line that I didn't know about, and so I'm really curious about that and how it would inform the work. So I just allow myself to go down rabbit holes.
Yeah, no, I love that. And as I'm reading a little bit more about your show at Dinner Gallery that opens next week, Thursday, I'm thinking about your use of color and this kind of shift in your practice where colors are slightly nuanced and slightly different. And for folks in the audience who are familiar with your work and who've seen it before, how would you say, or what would you say folks will encounter in this show that could be either slightly a departure from what they've seen in the past or potentially a continuation of things that you've explored in your practice thus far?
Yeah, I think there's both. There's continuations and departures. For sure, if anybody's deeply familiar with the work, I think there's some Easter eggs in this, which aren't even, like, I don't even know how obvious they are, but there's, if you've seen images of the earlier work around Vera Otis, some of the imagery gets repeated. But some of the departures, I would say, is it's not maybe so much a departure as, like, a focus on color as mood and, like, really thinking about the overall emotional register of each image, and especially as I'm, like, juxtaposing images of Vera and her space with this Tarver plantation imagery, or like those things coming against each other, it's looking at what those do next to each other and like similarities and differences and like allowing color, mood, there's like formal elements of like composition and stuff, but because I've gone back into painting for the show and it's primarily a painting show, I'm allowing those formal elements to really heighten the emotional register of the different pieces.
When you think about your work and your impact and what it is that you want to do, is any part of the way that you're thinking really what the viewer is going to experience when they're face-to-face with the work? Or are you, do you more take the perspective of just focusing on what it is that you're doing and then not being really informed or considering your audience?
Another one that I think about a lot with teaching, because I think so much of my perspective on that shifted while I was in school, and it has a little bit to do with why I stopped doing images of my family and started to shift to a character outside of my family, and that there was this recognition that no matter, especially I'm a representational painter, I paint figures and they're going to be Black, I'm interested in painting Black figures, and there was this recognition in a critique that the figures being Black meant that the audience automatically had a set of assumptions about them that had nothing to do with my intention. And that was a moment of, oh, okay, this is a conversation between me and the viewer, and I'm going to play with your assumptions. Where Vera lives, her house, the accoutrement of her lifestyle, is very much about what the assumptions might be of who she is and what happens if she's in this space. Do you assume that she owns this space? Do you assume that she's visiting this space? How do your assumptions inform her place in the world? It felt more like, oh, this can actually in some ways be a mirror and an interaction, however subtle, between the audience and myself as an artist with my own intentions.
Yeah, I love that you're bringing that up, because it's pulling up so much of so many things and conversations I've had as of lately about people being identified or assumptions are made about them just based on how they look. Like, you know, somebody, I had an interview with Gabriel Moses. In our conversation, I recall him saying, like, it's crazy to be a photographer on a Louis Vuitton campaign or a Nike campaign, or like walking in a store and the security guard will follow me. Right? They won't assume that I'm there to buy something, but I was just in the studio working with this whole team. But nobody would ever know that if you looked at how I present, right? Because our assumptions that we make about people based on how they look are usually wrong, right? Like, inherently, there's so much bias in how one categorizes or places a person just based on their physical appearance, on the color of their skin. And when you think about Black people too, it's like on the shade of their skin, right? That is also such a big part of it. And I think those are also conversations that I have among people where we're talking about ideas and we're talking about issues of racism and we're talking about things that are happening in our political system right now. These are issues that we're all faced with, whether we're engaging with them or not, right? But the inherent biases that we may hold, and also the inherent biases that others who are looking at you may hold. And so I think what's interesting too is to reflect on not only how one handles it for themselves and addressing what their own biases are, but also looking out into the world and recognizing when you're on the other end of that. And I think as Black people in the world, one could say you experience that a lot. It's conditional. But yet at the same time, with projects like this and with an exhibition like this and with the way I think that you're tackling something with so many layers, and there's so many different ways that you're thinking about not only the figure herself, Vera Otis, and the character and what she represents, but also your use of color, the context of the space, and how that informs what one might be thinking. It's playing with all of these different ideas in very subtle and sometimes overt ways, which I love.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And especially it's the nuance keeps going. It's not just black or white. It's the shades within black. It's all of these layered assumptions and internal critiques, external critiques. I think ultimately I'm most interested in exploring the nuance and not trying to define anything as this or that, or even right or wrong. Clearly I have my own feelings about right or wrong, but it's more of what do your observations say about you and what you're perceiving of this scenario, and it's not necessarily going to be in line with my own. It's very interesting to over time have that conversation with the audience and let it build.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Adrienne, this was a wonderful episode. Thank you so much for joining me. For the folks listening in, this is our episode with Adrienne Elise Tarver. She has her show opening next week at Dinner Gallery, Where the Waters Go. Can't wait to see the show. And for the folks listening, join us. It'll be opening next week, Thursday, May 16th, from 6 to 8 at Dinner Gallery in the city. So hope to see you there. Adrienne, thank you so much for a great episode.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
That was my episode with Adrienne Elise Tarver. I want to give a big shout out and a thank you to Adrienne for joining me on the show.
And it's a wrap, folks. That was our episode of Everything is Connected, conversations on culture and current events with some of today's hottest creative contemporaries. These episodes are recorded remotely and on location wherever in the world I find myself, whether that be the US, Africa, Europe, the Middle East, the Caribbean, and more. Depending on where I am at the time of these recordings, you will hear the sights and the sounds of my local environment. I look forward to continuing these wonderful conversations with artists and creative professionals across industries with you. I'm your host, Folashade Ologundudu, and we'll see you next time. As always, stay motivated, stay inspired, and stay up. Peace and love, y'all. We out.